Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith and would be interested in discussing those here, I am interested in having you do so. And so you may call me at 1-800-438-5090. Now our lines are all open right now, and if you call now, you'll get right through. You wait till later in the program, you might get through, you might not. It's hard to say. It's a guarantee, if you call early, that we will be able to get to your call and take time with your question. I should say it's a guarantee, assuming the phone lines work. They do, I believe, and they did yesterday. We had some problems with them 2 days ago, but I think we found the problem and fixed it. So, with that one caveat, I can guarantee that we will give your call attention for sure if you call within the next few minutes, and even if you call later in the program, there's a very good chance you may be able to get through. The number, 1-800-438-5090. Now, I mentioned yesterday that I do plan to be coming up to Santa Cruz to speak in about 2 weeks from this weekend. So not this weekend or the one after, but the one after that. It'd be Saturday the 24th of January. We do think we have a venue for that gathering in Santa Cruz, but it needs to be confirmed. There's some negotiations about what it's costing us to use the facilities. So we will we'll let you know soon about the location, but it's fairly certain we will be in Santa Cruz January 24th, and we'll have more details about that soon, and they will be posted on the website as well as announced on the air. And for our listeners up in Oregon, of which there are a great number, I've booked a venue in McMinnville, Oregon, for Saturday, or is it Friday? It's March 29th or 28th. We don't have it established yet because we have several. I do have one venue booked. We have several days in a row that we'll probably be booking things in that area. Let me just say that the last weekend of March, I plan to be in the Portland area. And some of the times of the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there are some time slots that I would be available that have not been booked. So if you are in the Portland area and you have a venue, it could be a home gathering, or it could be a church, or it could be some kind of other facility. I don't charge anything to speak, and I'm coming up anyway. There'll be no expenses for you to worry about as far as transportation. So it's just a matter of booking a venue and settling it and announcing it. So that would also go for Salinas and Monterey for this this January visit in Santa Cruz. If you ever hear I'm coming up to your area, feel free to contact me about speaking in your church or your home or wherever it is that you might have meetings. And I just want you to know, at the end of this month, Santa Cruz, at the end of March, the Portland area in Oregon. All right, let's go to the phones and talk to, first of all, Brian from Orcas Island, Washington. I've been on Orcas Island, I believe, or at least I've seen it from one of the other islands. I think, yeah, we were on Orcas Island. That's true. Hi, welcome to the Narrow Path, Brian.
Hey, thanks, Greg. I was on your show a couple weeks ago. I'm in a Bible study men's group going through your book right now, The Four Versions of Revelation.
Uh-huh.
I've got a question, Greg, just on Daniel. I mean, I have another friend that's a futurist that, Christ can't come yet because the 1 week in Daniel's not been fulfilled yet. I know that's probably a long response from you, but where would a guy go to? Because even in your book, we're not in Daniel, or is it right. Irrelevant? I'm not sure, that seventh week.
From my point, it's irrelevant. From the dispensational point, it's not irrelevant. So, and you're right, it could be a long answer, but it doesn't have to be. The short answer is that the reason he believes the 70th week of Daniel has not yet happened is because he is assuming that there is a huge gap of something like 2,000 years between the 69th and the 70th week of Daniel. Now, he's not alone in that. Lots of people mm-hmm. believe there's a gap like that. All dispensationalists do, and I think there might even be some people who aren't dispensationalists who've held that view. I don't know, but the point is, if you actually read Daniel chapter 9, where the 70 weeks are discussed, there's not the slightest hint of a gap. In fact, it would be certainly a departure from literal translation of the Bible, which dispensationalists usually advocate, it's a huge departure from that to find a gap between the 69th and the 70th weeks. For those of you who are already lost about this, because the 70 weeks of Daniel is a perplexing thing and some of you may not be familiar, there's a prophecy in Daniel 9, and a great deal is made of it, and it should be, because an angel appears to Daniel and tells him that there's a particular time frame between two events, one event in Daniel's own time, and the other event is the Messiah's coming. So essentially, the angel tells Daniel how many years it will be from an event in his own time, or at least shortly after his time, which is identified as the going forth of a decree to rebuild and restore Jerusalem. Now, that had already happened. Cyrus had already given his decree in Daniel's time. Artaxerxes was going to make that a similar decree twice after Daniel's time. But the point is, it was very near Daniel's time and going up to the time of the Messiah. Now, this period of time was said to be 70 weeks. Now, of course, that's confusing because we think of a week as a period of 7 days, but it's very evident that in the Hebrew, it doesn't say weeks, it says sevens, 70 sevens. So if you have 70 times 7, you've got 490. Virtually all conservative scholars believe that this is a reference to years, that from Daniel's time, or at least from the decree to go for, that goes forth to rebuild Jerusalem, till the Messiah would be 490 years. That's 70 sevens. Now, the prophecy goes further. Now, this whole prophecy is found in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 29, but the prophecy goes further and divides the 70 sevens into three segments. It says there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens, and then there's another 7. Now, if you do the math, this is not too difficult. 7 sevens plus 62 sevens makes a total of 69 sevens. 7 and 62 is 69, and then there's one more, a 70th one. Now, what dispensational scholars say, and what your friend apparently believes, is that 69 of these sevens transpired by the time Jesus came the first time, that Jesus came at the end of the 69th week, or the 69th seven.
Right.
Of course, they assume that the first 7 sevens and the next 62 sevens do not have a gap between them. Although they are mentioned separately, there's no pretense that there's a gap. No one believes there were, 49 years, and then a gap. And then somewhere after that gap, the next 62 sevens began. All people that I know of believe that the first 69 sevens ran sequentially without a gap. Okay? Now, what about the 70th one? Would it also come after the 69th seven?
You would think.
Without a gap? You'd think so, unless you were told otherwise. And yet, there is no suggestion otherwise. There's not one thing in the prophecy that would give even the slightest hint that the angel intended for Daniel to see a gap between the end of the 69th week and the beginning of the 70th week. Yet all dispensationalists assume there is a gap there. Now, as I said, dispensationalists are very fond of saying that they take the Bible literally, but if they put a gap there, they're doing the opposite. A literal interpretation of Daniel's 70 weeks would make a 490-year unbroken period. After all, before the angel broke it up into pieces, he said the whole number. From this period to this event, from this event to this event is going to be 490 years. That's a total number of years. He then said there's going to be, you can look at this in three segments, but he didn't indicate that there's any gaps between the segments. The total number is still 490 years. Now, what the dispensation says is the first 69 sevens transpired when Jesus came. And so 483 years had happened, and there's 7 years more. And they have basically postponed the 70th week until what they consider to be a future tribulation period, which has not even now begun. So it's still in the future. So from the time of Jesus, which is the end of the 69th week, to the beginning of the 70th week, which hasn't even happened yet, is essentially about 2,000 years, which means when the angel told Daniel that the whole period is 490 years, the angel was very misleading, because it was not 490 years, it was 2,490 years. In other words, it was five times the length of time that the angel suggested. Now, that's not even approximate. That's a difference of a factor of five, you know, 490 right. years, you know, and
why
you add.
Was it,
go ahead.
Why was it broken then in that, and what would be specific of the last seven that they believe is yet to come?
Well, I'll tell you why they break it up. They don't do it because of anything in the passage. It certainly is. They cannot claim for a moment that they're following a literal interpretation of the passage. But what they are doing is imposing a theological assumption into some of the wording. And if their assumption is correct, then they have to insert a gap like that. Of course, the fact that no gap is suggested in the passage might raise questions about their theological assumptions, which would require such a gap. But let me just say what it is. Here we have, it says, in verse 26 of Daniel 9, after the 62 weeks, and of course that's after the 7 weeks and the 62 weeks, so it's really at the end of 69 weeks total, the Messiah shall be cut off. So it's very plainly said the Messiah would be killed at the end of the 69 weeks, or sometime after 69 weeks had passed, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, that's the Romans. They came and destroyed the city, Jerusalem, and the sanctuary of the temple. So this is a prediction about the crucifixion of Christ and the subsequent destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70. The end of it shall be with a flood, excuse me, which usually means either an invasion of armies or else a dispersion. In biblical prophecy, the word flood is used a number of ways. In Isaiah 10, it refers, for example, to the invasion of the Assyrians to in Judah, a flood of armies. But also a flood can refer to a dispersion. It's not clear which it is here, since both occurred. There was a flood of armies, the Romans, and there was a dispersion of the Jews. So the flood could refer to either. And it says, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. The end of the war? What war? Well, the war that the Romans waged against Jerusalem has caused the end of Jerusalem. This is all that's been discussed, nothing more. Then it says in verse 27, and this is where the dispensationalists begin to be innovative. It says in verse 27, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Okay, now he shall confirm covenant with many.
They're saying that he is the Antichrist.
They are saying that he is the Antichrist. That's right. Now, that's their assumption. And it says he will confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. That is the final 70th week. So they say, okay, if this is the Antichrist, and if the Antichrist hasn't come yet, then this 70th week hasn't come yet. So their assumption that he, in verse 27, is the Antichrist, is that which necessitates them putting a gap there, because they know that the Messiah in the previous verse was Jesus 2,000 years ago. And that was at the end of the 69th week. And so since the 70th week begins with him confirming a covenant for a week, and then in the middle of the week causing the sacrifices and offerings to cease, they apply this to the Antichrist. But there's no reason in the passage to do so. In the passage there is no reference to an Antichrist. Okay, the Antichrist has not been mentioned in the passage at all. And whenever you have a pronoun like he, unless the person writing is incompetent in communication, they are referring back by that pronoun to some subject that has been mentioned. Well, there's been no mention of Antichrist, but there's been several mentions in the previous two verses of the Messiah. And obviously, someone who didn't have dispensational assumptions driven into their skull, in reading that, they would immediately think, oh, he, of course, Messiah, that's who was mentioned, that's who's under discussion here. The passage is about the Messiah, and so he will confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, after 3.5 years, he'll put an end to the sacrificial system. Well, if you're a Christian reading that and didn't have other people telling you otherwise, you'd say, okay, Jesus began his ministry at the beginning of the 70th week, but before it got finished, 3.5 years into it, he put an end to the system. How? By dying. He put an end to the sacrificial system. His death was the last sacrifice God will ever acknowledge in the system. There's no more system of sacrifices that God acknowledges. Now, of course, the Jews still offered sacrifices, and pagans still do it all over the world, but no sacrifice that's ever offered since then has been valid because Christ put an end to that system, its validity, and so forth. Now, that would be the natural reading. So,
right.
But if they want to be unnatural and say he is now speaking of a character who's not even been mentioned previously in the passage, well, then they can say, okay, this is the Antichrist. In the future, he's going to make a 7-year covenant with Israel, which they claim, but no other place in the Bible says so. And that in the middle of the tribulation, he's going to end the sacrificial system by putting an image of himself in the temple. Now, every dispensationalist believes this, but what most dispensationalists don't know is, and I don't say this irresponsibly, I welcome any dispensationalist to call and show me to be wrong about this. Here's what I'm going to say. There's not one line in the Bible that speaks of an Antichrist putting an image of himself in a temple. Okay? There's not one line that speaks of a 7-year tribulation. There's not one line in the Bible that teaches that an Antichrist will make a 7-year covenant with Israel and break that covenant in the middle by putting an image of. None of that is in there. All of that is read into this passage. And it does so by suggesting that he is no longer the Messiah, which he was in the previous verses. He is now an Antichrist who has not been introduced. Now, this, to my mind, is not good biblical exegesis. It is exegesis of convenience. And, convenience is not the best way to decide the truth of the Bible. Your friend who says the 70th week has not yet happened has been taken in by this dispensational, propaganda, I guess, because there's certainly nothing in the Bible that would suggest that the 70th week is still in the future, any more than the 69th week or the 68th week or any of the other previous weeks. Now,
one question, I don't want to take everybody's call that wants to go in. Now, if you've broken up that 1 week into two sections, you have the start of the ministry and then Christ's crucifixion. Is there anything that the 3.5 years after that to add up to 7 that happens that you would say is historical?
Probably. We don't have the exact dates of the crucifixion of Christ or even of some of the other events in the book of Acts, but we do know that it was approximately 3 years or so. We don't have exact numbers. It was approximately 3 years after the crucifixion of Christ that Saul was converted and became a Paul. Now, why would that be important? It's important because the 70 weeks are said to be concerning God's dealings with Israel. Okay? And so they do it. God was dealing primarily with Israel, and even after Christ died, still God was dealing essentially almost exclusively with the Jews. He had not yet authorized any apostle to the Gentiles. And when Paul was converted, which is approximately 3-something years after the cross, could well have been 3.5 years, we don't know exactly. But one thing is that Paul's conversion is very significant because he was made the first apostle to the Gentiles specifically. And that would mark the end of the season where God is dealing exclusively with Israel. Israel still existed after that for some time until the fall of Jerusalem, but still God's dealing shifted. And although God still was reaching out to Jews, not exclusively, it was no longer the case that Israel was the focus of God's dealings. Now the whole world was, and Paul's activities outside of Israel in the Gentile lands would be an example of that.
Well, you've answered it very simply and beautifully for me, Greg. Is there any, have you written on it? Is there on your website? Is there any, do you have more? Do you break this down in paper?
Well, most of my teaching is not on paper. It's a recorded MP3 files. And of course, at the website, we have hundreds of MP3 files, but there are verse-by-verse teachings through Daniel, and I certainly go into it when we go through Daniel 9 verse-by-verse, just like I have here. There's also a set of lectures called When Shall These Things Be, which is my set on eschatology. It's 14 lectures, and there's some lectures there about the tribulation and therefore dealing with the dispensational claim that the 70th week of Daniel is a future tribulation. I go through some of this too. And at our Bible Forum, I'm pretty sure I've probably written on it here or there, but I don't know where to find it. There's hundreds or thousands, actually, of posts there over the years answering Bible questions. I know I've answered this one before, but you'd have to go looking for it. I do want to say one more thing, because I don't want to leave out anything the dispensationalists might say in defense of their view. I've mentioned that he, in Daniel 9:27, is the Messiah, and that there's been no previous reference to the Antichrist. The dispensationalists say, au contraire, there is a reference to the Antichrist prior to this. Where is it? Well, when it says the Messiah will be cut off, and it says, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. They say the prince who is to come, that's the Antichrist. And therefore, Daniel has introduced the prince who is to come. But they acknowledge that the destruction of the city and the sanctuary is the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by the Romans. So the people of the prince who is to come, all dispensationalists, I think, will acknowledge that's the Romans, the people of the prince who is to come. Based on that, they assume the Antichrist is going to be a Roman, because it was the Romans who destroyed Jerusalem, and they were the people of the prince who is to come. However, to make him a prince who would come a lot later is not called for. The prince who was to come was Titus. He was the prince who led the Roman armies against Jerusalem. The most natural way to understand it is this is not reference to some Antichrist. This is a reference to the prince of whom the people were. It'd be strange to refer to the revolutionary armies of America who fought battles hundreds of years ago for the liberation of American Britain to, in some prophecy, be referred to as the people of Barack Obama, just because he happened to be the ruler of those people generations later. The people who fought the British were not the people of Barack Obama. They were more the people of Washington,
Washington, yeah.
So, I mean, in other words, to say that that Daniel is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which all, even dispensationalists recognize this, and it's the Romans who are the people referred to, and they are called the people of the prince who is to come. Why wouldn't it be the prince that was their leader that he's referring to, rather than some prince that would come thousands of years later and call them the people of that man? It's unnatural in the extreme. It's very clear that a much more natural reading of the Bible and taking the grammar normal would see he not as a reference to some future prince. And, by the way, the prince who is to come, a phrase that appears there in verse 26, is not even the subject of a sentence. He's the object of a prepositional phrase. He's not a major noun in the previous sentence. It's not even the prince who is to come who does the action. It's the people of the prince who is to
right.
come. So the prince who is to come certainly would not point at all anywhere beyond 70 AD and would be Titus the Roman Emperor, presumably. But not only that, he's not even mentioned as a main part of the sentence. So why would then the discussion, which has been all about the Messiah, shift so that he is now the prince who is to come, when he didn't even have a significant role in the grammar of the sentence that mentions him? So dispensationalism has all of this to answer for, and they don't mind. They don't mind answering for it. They make assertions. They don't defend them very well, but they make them a lot. And then because they make them boldly and frequently, the average Christian who hears them just assumes there must be something behind that.
Well, it's kind of all you hear right now, Pastor, so it's a tough fight.
Well, it depends on where you listen. If you go to our website, you'll hear other things.
Right. Well, I sure appreciate your answer. I'll listen now on the radio and see if there's any rebuttals. And Lord bless your afternoon, and thank you again.
Thank you, Brian. Good to hear it from you. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and like Brian said, if there's any rebuttals, he wants to hear them, so would I. If you're a dispensationalist, if you think you've got a really, really good reason for saying the 70th week of Daniel has been postponed for 2,000 years after the 69th week, and for saying that the prince who's to come is the Antichrist, feel free. I'll be glad to hear you. I won't be silent, but I'll be glad to hear you. We'll talk about it, and that'll be fun, won't it? The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Celine, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Celine. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a quick question off that subject, something
okay.
else. In Matthew 27, verses 52 and 53, after Jesus' crucifixion, it talks about, how it got dark for the 3 hours.
People
and
came out of the graves.
Yes. Is there more stuff around? I mean, it's only in that one gospel, and I mean, it's an amazing thing. They went in and appeared to many. Is there more stuff written about that all over? I mean, you'd think it would be phenomenal and it'd be all over.
You'd think so. Matthew 27:52 says that when Jesus died, it says the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep, or who, that is, who had died, were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. And that's all we hear about them. Now, it does seem pretty remarkable, and yet Matthew tells us only, you know, a sentence or two about them, and then goes on to other matters. And the other Gospels, as you say, don't mention them at all. In fact, this is the only place in the Bible that mentions this. Now, what that means is, if we're going to know anything about it, we're going to get it from this passage and no others, because there aren't any others to help us. At least I don't think there are.
I'm so sorry. Well, there wasn't stuff written like, you know, how Josephus wrote different things that went on in the time. There's not, like, lots of other stuff written about this phenomenon?
No, Josephus doesn't mention this particular phenomenon. Josephus mentions a few supernatural things that happened in connection with the Jewish war, but he doesn't, you know, he's largely not telling Christian history. Josephus is a Jewish historian, and he didn't believe in Christianity, and therefore he even passes over the whole life of Jesus rather briefly with a few sentences. So he doesn't mention these kinds of phenomena. The temple, you know, the veil of the temple tearing and people coming out of graves and stuff. Now, I will say this. There are some people, and I don't share their view, but some people believe that this is figurative. I don't think it is, because Matthew's narrative usually isn't figurative. It's usually just a straightforward historical narrative. But some people think that Matthew added these lines about the temple, the veil of the temple being torn and people rising from the dead and so forth, to suggest spiritual realities that are associated with Jesus' death. When Jesus died, you know, the separation between the people and the Holy of Holies vanished. God opened a new and living way, and speaking of the veil tearing would be simply symbolic of that. And likewise, speaking of people coming out of graves would suggest that, you know, we pass from death unto life because of Christ's death. I reject that particular interpretation, but it is one that has been suggested. It kind of makes Matthew drift from a literal narrative to almost an interpretive spiritual, commentary. And I don't think Matthew did that. From this passage, what I would deduce is that when Jesus rose from the dead, some other people did too. Now, that's not too amazing, since Jesus raised some people from the dead even before he died. You know, he raised Lazarus, he raised Jairus' daughter, he raised the son of the widow of Nain. He even sent his disciples out on one occasion and gave them power to raise the dead and heal the sick, and apparently they did. So people who were dead had been being raised somewhat through the ministry of Jesus and even his disciples the previous 3 years to this. These people being raised on this occasion would simply have to be added to the number. Now, how many? It says many, but what's many? I'll tell you what, if three people rise from the dead, that's a lot, because usually no one does, you know? If one does, that's a lot. But so, I mean, it could be that there were a dozen, you know, we don't know how many there were. There could have been a handful or a dozen, but there were a number, you know, not just one or two, but several people came out of the graves. Now, who were these saints? You know, we might think of them as being the Old Testament saints, Moses, you know, Elisha, the prophet, maybe Isaiah came out. But that's not who it's talking about, I don't believe. And the reason I say that is because it doesn't say that these people were reconstituted as they will be in the resurrection of the last day, where God has to take all the dust that they've, you know, dissolved into and put it back together miraculously. It's just they came out. These were bodies that apparently had not been decomposed, probably like Lazarus had been. I mean, these people that Jesus raised in his lifetime had not decomposed. They were still intact, and Jesus simply called them back to life. That's probably the case with these people too. And one reason for my saying so, besides the fact that it doesn't suggest that they had to be reconstructed from basic elements again, that means they hadn't decomposed much, but it also suggests they were recognized in town. Now, nobody in town would recognize Elisha the prophet or Isaiah, since nobody had seen them. You know, they didn't have photographs of these guys. So, you know, if a man walked up and said, "Hey, it's me, Isaiah, I'm back," you know, everyone would say, "Yeah, sure. Why should I believe you? You don't look like, I don't know what Isaiah looks like." You know, obviously, if people recognize them, it seems to me they must have been people who had died not so long ago, that people who were surviving had known them and would know who they were when they saw them. Therefore, the word saints, which means holy ones, would probably simply mean, you know, faithful, godly Jewish people who had been, you know, part of the faithful remnant of Israel. Some of them had died, probably recently. And when Jesus rose from the dead, just as he had previously raised Lazarus and some other people, he raised some of these people as well. And, you know, it's interesting. It is remarkable, but the raising of Lazarus is only mentioned in John's gospel and nowhere else, although it's given much more attention than this particular statement in Matthew. But, you know, sometimes tremendous miracles that were associated with Jesus were mentioned only one by one author. And maybe that's because Matthew and other authors have recorded so many miracles of Jesus, it's hard for them to really quantify how stupendous any given miracle was and how negligent it would be for them to leave one out of any particular kind. Mark and Luke may have left this out simply because their books were already chock full of other miracles, including Jesus raising people from the dead, and they just felt like this was one that, you know, like the many that could be left out. Remember, John said that the number of miracles Jesus did were so great that the books of the whole world couldn't contain them. So obviously all the Gospels, though they record numerous miracles of Jesus, all of them omit far more than they include. And that may explain why Matthew includes this and other Gospels do not. They include other ones.
Wow. Well, great. Thank you. Food for thought. Appreciate it. Thank you for using your talent the way you do. It's a wonderful ministry. We appreciate it. And have a wonderful day.
All right. And thanks to you and Terrence for your support of the ministry.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye now. Okay, Michael from Santa Cruz, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I'm glad that you got the radio bugs worked out the other day.
Well, I didn't, but I'm glad they got worked out. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, all the years that I've been listening, that's never happened before that I remember. So.
Nor I.
But anyway, so what I've been wondering about, so Jesus existed about 2,000 years ago, and at that time, in the East, there had already been the various Hindu streams of teaching, and Buddhism rose 500 years before that and had already spread. And Jesus, he lived in, what was that, Babylon?
He lived in Palestine. He lived in Israel.
All right. Which is roughly where modern-day Israel is?
Yes, essentially the same boundaries.
Oh, all right.
Slightly different boundaries, but certainly the main body of the land of Israel was the same as is now.
All right. And so obviously the population of the planet was a lot smaller back then.
Mm-hmm.
But
considerably.
There were people all over the globe, as far as we know. I mean, definitely in Asia. So he was speaking to a very small group of people in a very localized region.
That's true.
They were already teachings that were well established, you know, that had been, you know, hundreds or thousands of years before that. And as far as I know, he didn't specifically refute, say, the Eastern teachings. I mean, I don't even know if he was aware.
He probably was not aware of them. And there'd be no reason for him to refute them in Israel, since Israel had a very dominating religious culture that was not Hindu and not Buddhist. It was Jewish.
Right.
And Judaism was very much defined by the Old Testament law and by the writings of the rabbis, who were very strictly bound to their interpretations of the law, which means the entire culture that Jesus spoke to was really Jewish. I mean, if there was a Gentile or two in the crowd that was not committed to Judaism, it was probably somebody who was just visiting from out of town. For the most part, all of Jesus' hearers were established in Judaism, and probably had never heard of Buddha or of Krishna or any of the Eastern religions.
So to infer from the scriptures that Jesus would have been down on, say, all other dharmas, all other, say, religious paradigms, I can sort of see why the Christians would jump to that conclusion, but it also seems like a bit of a stretch.
Well, you said that you know, you said that it's a bit of a stretch to say that Jesus would be down on all other religious paradigms. I don't know, you know, to what degree Jesus would be down on them, but he would disagree with them. That's the main thing.
That's
you
what
can,
I meant. That's
yeah, you can, as soon as you believe anything, you disagree with things that aren't that thing. I mean, that contradict it, obviously. I mean, Jesus wouldn't have to be taking a negative view of anything in particular in order to take a positive view of something. Every time, I mean, for example, you affirm or have in the past Buddhism, and in doing so, you're not affirming animism or belief in the Greek gods or Christianity or even Judaism. In other words, as soon as you believe something, your beliefs contradict all beliefs that are contradictory to it. And so Jesus wouldn't necessarily have to be negatively inclined toward other people's search for God, even if they were blind and in systems that Jesus did not agree with. But he would disagree with them. And the question is not, of course, would Jesus be down on it so much as would Jesus teach it? What Jesus taught is the truth. What wasn't taught by Jesus, or let's just say what's contrary to what Jesus taught, would by definition not be true if that's the case. And so Christians believe that Jesus is the truth, that what he taught is reliable, and whatever religions teach that are contradictory to what Jesus taught are simply not true. You see, we believe, people believe there's absolute truth. It is sometimes fashionable in some circles to deny that there's absolute truth. New Agers like to deny that. And there are lots of people today who just assume there's no absolute truth. But even though they say that, that's their philosophical stated position. That's not really the way they live. They know that gravity is an absolute truth. I mean, they know very well that, you know, if they jump off a building that's 3 feet high, gravity will pull them down, and they'll have a chance to jump off another one. And if they jump off a 5 foot high one, it's going to pull them down. And by the time they're jumping off 20-foot buildings, well, they're not going to do that, because they know that there's absolute certainty that if they jump off that building, they're going to hit the ground hard. There's, you know, physical laws are absolute, at least in terms of nature. God can violate them if he wants to, but he doesn't do it very often. You know, when people go to the store and buy something, they know how much change they should get back for the money they hand the cashier. There's no question as to what the amount is. Mathematics is absolute. There is absolute truth. And likewise, there's absolute truth about spiritual reality. For example, either there is a God or there's not a God. Okay? You can either say there is a God, or there are at least one God. Maybe you'd affirm there's many gods, or there's no God. You can't really have it all ways. You can't have someone saying there is a God and another person saying there isn't a God and both of them be right. They're contradicting each other. So Buddhism, of course, does not teach that there's a God, but Jesus does teach there's a God. And so Jesus would not affirm Buddhism for that reason. It contradicts what he says. Now, even though the Buddha came before Jesus did on the earthly scene, Jesus came from higher up.
They never actually met.
No, they would have no opportunity to meet because they were separated by 500 years. But the point is that Jesus came from heaven, unless he lied about it. He said he came from heaven. And the Buddha didn't make any claims like that.
Well, it would have been interesting if they had met. I would have been very pleased to have been.
Well, I think they've met now. I believe they have now met.
The world back then, there was no internet, there was no television, radio, so whatever was going on in one particular region, it was pretty much confined to that region.
That's why Jesus, when he rose from the dead, commanded his disciples to go to all the countries. Because until that time, you know, his teachings and his beliefs were confined to that one region, but he didn't want it to stay that way, so he commanded his disciples to go out and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them to observe everything he said.
He actually said that's in one of the
that's his final recorded statements in the Gospel of Matthew are, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, therefore go out and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. So, that was Jesus' commission. And it's, on another occasion, in Acts chapter 1, it records that Jesus said to the disciples, tarry in Jerusalem until you receive power from on high. He says, but when the Holy Spirit's come upon you, you'll receive power, and you'll be my witnesses to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So Jesus made it very clear that he intended that his ideas would not remain confined to that little geographical area. They were to spread and cover the world.
Yeah, they certainly have.
That's true.
No doubt about that.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I've got my lines full. But,
okay, Steve, thank you. Look forward to seeing you soon, hopefully.
Yeah, I hope to see you in a couple weeks.
Okay.
All right. Bye now. Kevin from Amity. I imagine Kevin is responding to my request that people call to disagree with me about the 70 weeks. Is that correct, Kevin?
That's correct.
Yes. Welcome.
Hey, but I'm one of your callers before. She's talking about the resurrection and the people that resurrected and then they went into Jerusalem.
Yeah.
They didn't just go into Jerusalem by themselves. And you remember that a pattern was established going way back to David, Nathaniel, and Asa, who led the music back then. Way back in the first temple time, there was a pattern in it, and on this particular day, all the priests would go out, and many of the people would go out to a field, and they would harvest it, and it would be the first fruits harvest, and then they would come back. Those
True.
Graves that are open were on the side of the mountain that they would pass by. So I think it would be likely that they actually saw them coming out.
So and when the Jews were going up gathering the first fruits of the barley harvest for the feast for the festival first fruits, they would be out in the areas where these people were being raised. That's possible.
Right. And that would have been the time that Christ would have resurrected from the dead. It would have, rather than a Sunday morning, that would have been what we call our Saturday evening, which would have been the first, part of the first day of the week.
Well, that's entirely possible.
Yeah, I think that's more than possible. I think it's probable. Now, as far as this Antichrist, interesting. Antichrist is given used the word for, we say, well, we can't find Antichrist being used to a specific person.
Mm-hmm.
But we do find a pattern of the guy who speaks pompous words. We see
the little horn.
Daniel 7. Yep.
Yeah, the little horn,
and we see it in Revelation. Okay, so, and he does blasphemies. And so I think rather than trying, I think there is reason to use the word Antichrist, but I think the prince to come would have been this little horn, which they would have been familiar with, and that's who Daniel was talking about, the prince who is to come. That's the one he already spoke about, the little horn, and that's the one he's referring to in Daniel chapter 9.
So are you saying that the little horn in Daniel 7 was somehow referred to previously as the prince who's to come, and therefore they would recognize that term to refer to the little horn?
No, I think in chapter 7 he defines the prince who is to come. He defines this ruler who speaks pompous words and persecutes the saints.
Yeah, but the prophecy of Daniel 9, the prophecy of Daniel 9 doesn't follow, seamlessly from the prophecy of 7. In chapter 8, which intervenes, an entirely different prophetic vision comes up, where the little horn in chapter 8 of Daniel is Antiochus Epiphanes. And so chapter 8 intervenes between chapter 7 and 9. So again, when chapter 9 mentions the prince that is to come, there's been a lot of princes that have been mentioned in the previous chapters that would come. Alexander the Great has been mentioned. Antiochus Epiphanes has been mentioned. The little horn has been mentioned. So there's really nothing in the immediate previous material that would tip off the reader that that Daniel's referring to the prince who is to come when he talks about how he will come and do these things, and that he means the little horn in 7.
Okay, well, but when I go to the scriptures and I take a look, there's a pattern of an individual that is always seen, and he's the guy who speaks the pompous words. He's the guy, I believe, that he's talking about in chapter 9. He also is referred to, and he's the Matthew 24 is talking about, and he's also the person that we see talked about in Revelation. And they tie it all together using different things that you see tied together, such as times, and half a times, terminology like that, 42 months, all referring to the 3.5 years. So, and interesting, I think another reason to see this is that some of the concepts that we hold to as dispensationalists, the term dispensation, you know, as a doctrinal position or something, might have gotten it later, but at the doctrinal positions that we have, such as a 1,000-year millennium reign, the future Antichrist, a 7-year tribulation, the reestablishment of Israel, these are things that was, some of these things were also taught by the Jews in the oral law before Christ came.
Right, and some of them are still taught
by some early church fathers.
Yeah, and some of them are still taught by people who are not dispensationalists, which means those are not the distinctives of dispensationalism. Those are views that dispensationalists hold. They also hold to the deity of Christ and the virgin birth, but that's not a distinctive of dispensationalism. To believe in a 1,000-year millennium is not a dispensational distinctive, since there are many people who are not dispensationalists who have held to the same view. When I talk about dispensational distinctives beginning in 1830 with John Nelson Darby, I'm talking about those things that are not held by non-dispensationalists and which have become very prominent in our modern teaching. Kevin, I'm almost out of time here. I've only got a few minutes. I got another call to take, but thank you for balancing comment.
Okay.
All right. Bye now. Kay from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for
calling. Well, yes. Hi there. Happy New Year to you, Steve. Thank you so much for all you do for all of us and the blessings. We appreciate that. And I got a lot of questions. I'm trying to catch up. But Easton, is it Easton Dictionary, Easton Bible?
Yes. There is an Easton. I think there's an Easton Dictionary of the Bible, if I'm not mistaken.
Is something like that available? I haven't had much blessing in finding one. I don't even know where I would. I don't even know what it contains. I mean, can you give me some idea what it actually is, or where one might locate it?
Okay, is there some reason why that particular name is what you're looking for? Are you just looking for a Bible dictionary? What are you looking for specifically?
It seemed to me, from what I've heard over periods of time, that seemed to be. I guess I was going to talk to you about words, and for instance, the definition of words. Take the word glory. I mean, today's understanding, previous understanding, to be able to understand that to the point where it opens up a comprehension that helps me and others understand what glory actually is. Because you hear this, you read it in a sentence, you read it in a paragraph, and yet the impact of what it really is, you don't get the depth unless you have the study of the particular word. And I have been looking for this particular Easton for a long time, and it just seems like it's unavailable. And it seemed as if from all points of view that I had and been in touch with, this seemed to be the best, but
have also heard of, I believe I've heard of the Easton Dictionary, but it's not on my shelf. I don't think that'd be the only one you'd look for. I would, if I were you, I would just go to christianbook.com and enter the words Dictionary of the Bible and see what comes up, because I would think there'd be quite a few of them, and the ones that are newer, I think, would normally be ones that have built on the research of earlier ones and incorporated new research. So even if there was an older one that was great, I would think newer ones would probably be even better.
Thank you. Can you, on occasion, for instance, say, bring up a word such as glory and then expound on definition, truth, power, those things, honor, you know, the really depth, because you hear the word, you have kind of a, you know, maybe a circular understanding of something, but yet when you begin to talk and put the bouquet of the flowery understanding of adjectives and pronouns and all of those, it just seems to open it up, Steve, and I so appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I don't choose the topics on the program, but people ask them. If somebody calls when I have more time,
yes,
because we're almost out of time now, but and specifically asks,
Okay, thank you.
You know, for discussion of those words, I'll be glad to do so.
Well,
listen, I'm looking for the
you know, information about all of the calendars that are accessible to us to understand time. And one other thing that maybe if you would be so kind to end with it today is Russian Christmas, and next Thursday is the New Year. And I wondered if you could maybe add a little of what exactly how that came about. Or
well, Eastern Orthodoxy has some different dates for their holidays. And since no one knows when Jesus really was born, and because traditions developed in the West independently of the East, the Eastern Church, which would include the Russian Orthodox, is the Eastern. They have different dates than the Western calendar has. I don't know why they chose the dates they do. I'm sure they had great reasons. I just have never inquired. And the reason is that I don't really think it's very important to celebrate these things. And so it's just one of those things I've never had the motivation to look into. Boy, I wonder why they chose that date. Because the truth is, holidays are not something that are a high priority on my personal Christian walk. But for those who want to know, you know, I'm sure you could just go to Wikipedia and they'd probably give you a pretty good answer to that question.
Well, I'd like to. Happy Holy Days, you know. I mean, that is really, and every day can be a holy day. But, you know, I just love to hear what you have to say on things. You are so, you bless us so much, and I appreciate so much what you do for us as a community out here. And thank you, and the best of the New Year to you, Steve.
Well, same to you, and thank you for those kind remarks. Yeah, there are some things I'm very ignorant about because they have never been something that mattered enough to me to study. You know, I'm not saying it's not important. What's important to you or someone else is important to you or someone else, and that's fine. I'm just saying there's limits on everybody's knowledge of things, and my limits are largely to things I have found interesting or important. Those are things I've studied out, things that have been interesting or important to somebody else but not to me have often not gotten the same attention, though I'm not saying that what interests me is more important than what's interests someone else. It's just more important to me and therefore has been priority in my study. I appreciate your asking. I appreciate all who've called today. We're just about out of time for the program, and so I just want to remind you that you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have a website, also thenarrowpath.com. And that website is so loaded with resources that if you haven't been there, you'd be really surprised if you go there. Maybe amazed. Because there's like 900 lectures of mine on MP3 files that you can just download for free. It doesn't cost anything. That includes verse-by-verse lectures through the entire Bible. It includes hundreds of different topics. Every topic, I think, that has ever been asked about on this program is treated in somewhat more length in our lectures somewhere. And although I can't tell you where to find everything because there's so many lectures and, you know, materials scattered around, they are, if you start listening to them, you'll probably hear a lot of your questions addressed. Anyway, it's all free, so what do you have got to lose besides the time taken to listen? The website is thenarrowpath.com, and there's other kind of resources there, too. There's some printed resources. You really probably, if you're a Bible student, would appreciate some of the things there. And so I just want you to know about it. That's at thenarrowpath.com. Now, The Narrow Path makes all these things free, and we don't have any sponsors. And you may have noticed that we have an hour-long program. We don't take a break to advertise any products and don't have anyone, you know, we're not selling advertising time because we don't do that. We depend on donors, and we just depend on letting you know that we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air on the radio program you're listening to, the station you're listening to, you can help us by writing to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or of course you can do so from our website, thenarrowpath.com. We're out of time for today, so tune in again tomorrow and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.